Support for WPR comes from Tomorrow River Community Virtual School, delivering Waldorf-inspired live virtual lessons to grades 4K through 8th, open to all Wisconsin students. More is at trcvs.org.
Support for WPR comes from UW-Superior Center for Continuing Education, offering Conversations on Living Alone, a three-part series beginning Wednesday, April 17th via Zoom. Details at uwsuper.edu.
It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Diane Ravitch is one of the top voices on education in America, a former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Education. She's now a research professor of education at New York University.
Ravitch used to be a champion of school reform, pushing for charter schools and for No Child Left Behind. But she has since had a change of heart and now campaigns against the same things, saying they just don't work. And we'd like to know what you think about privatizing schools. Will it help? Is the public school, in your estimation, the public school system in America truly broken? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can post a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
Diane Ravitch has a new book out. It's called Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. Diane, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you.
Well, let's key in on privatization. You hear a lot of talk about charter schools, voucher schools, school choice. People don't throw around the word privatization that often. You chose that word carefully. Why?
Well, because that's what's happening. It's happening all over the country. Part of what has happened over these past 20 years is we have been bombarded with a narrative that says our public schools are broken, our public schools are failing. And I sat down and did the research, which anybody could have done. I should have done it a long time ago. And what I discovered is our public schools are doing an absolutely fabulous job. In fact, the test scores today on the national test, the federal test, are the highest they've ever been in history for white kids, black kids, Hispanic kids, and Asian kids. The graduation rates are the highest they've ever been in history for all four of those groups. The dropout rates are the highest they've ever been in history. And yet we have people going around moaning and saying our public schools are broken. The reason they're saying that is because they then want people to say, woe is us. Let us hand our public schools over to private corporations to run. Let us hand them over to a charter chain. Let's hand them over to whoever comes along and says that they can fix them. But none of that works, and it just destroys public education.
Let's unpack some of that. Who is driving this argument that our public schools are failing?
Well, in the book, I quote chapter and verse with Bill Gates saying that our public schools are obsolete, with Michelle Rhee running around the country saying that our schools are failing, with Joel Klein and Condoleezza Rice having issued a report just a year ago. It was actually one of the motives for my writing this book, because they issued a report saying that the public school system in America was so terrible that it was a national security risk. And I began researching that while writing a review of their report and found out all of that wasn't true. So we also have heard this the same thing from Secretary Duncan, but I don't think he's actually read the data that's on the U.S. Department of Education's website.
Well, overall, maybe we're doing okay, but a lot of the argument is focused on schools in urban areas, saying we've got an achievement gap, that the schools are failing people there, not giving them a hope for their future. Is there a real problem in big city schools?
There is a huge problem caused by poverty. It's not caused by bad schools. Many of the schools that are being closed and called failing schools are schools that are overloaded with the problems of desperately poor children, many of whom have disabilities, very extreme disabilities, and they're not wanted in charter schools, many of whom don't speak English, and they're not wanted in the charter schools either because they'll drag the scores down. So in cities across the country, what's called failing schools are schools that just have the problems of poverty that are not being addressed, and there are things we can do to make those schools better. My view is that every time a school is closed, doesn't show that it was a failing school. It shows the failure of leadership, and the superintendent should be fired when he closes the school.
Well, let's turn toward the voucher, charter, school choice movement. The argument is we'll have competition. We'll have more innovation that currently isn't there under the bureaucracy, with the unions, the other things of the public schools. Isn't there some truth to that? Can't we see some improvements and some innovations in these schools?
No, actually, you can't see any truth to it. If you wanted to find the kind of poster district for why none of this is true, you would look at Milwaukee in your own state. And in Milwaukee, there has been now 23 years of vouchers and charters and a shrinking public sector. And Milwaukee is one of the lowest performing cities on the National Assessment of Educational Progress. All three sectors, by the way, vouchers, charters, and the public sector, the kids perform about the same in terms of the state test scores. So the competition has improved nothing, and the city as a whole has not improved, and that's all been money used to divide up public education into three competing sectors with no gains for the kids.
Let's look at some of the history of the school choice or the privatization movement. You, in your book, say for a while that was just on the fringe of, say, the Republican Party. How did it become such a big argument in American education?
Well, this is one of the most fascinating things that I see. I'm a historian. I've been studying American education and written books about it over the past 40-plus years. And school choice used to be the cry of the fringes of the far right. It was the battle cry of Governor George Wallace in Alabama. He wanted school choice so that white kids could go to some kids and black kids could go to some schools and black kids would go to other schools. And it was always considered a right-wing appeal. It was never considered liberal. Now you hear people on both sides of the aisle saying school choice is the civil rights issue of our time. That's ridiculous. That is, shows how the persistence of the right-wing think tanks, and I was part of two or three different right-wing think tanks, their persistence, their ability to fund the message, keep saying it again and again, and then this ongoing claim that our schools are worse than ever has made the public think, well, gosh, if our schools are worse than ever, we have to try anything. Why not try vouchers? Well, the fact is, the American public really likes their public schools. If you look at the last Gallup poll, which was done just a few weeks ago, people say, oh, American education is in terrible trouble, because they've heard that now on radio and TV for decades. But if you ask them, well, what about your neighborhood school? They'll say, oh, my neighborhood school is great. We have terrific teachers. So they really don't want their schools to be closed down. But this school choice claim that's being made is being made because of the misinformation about the performance of the system as a whole.
And you also try to follow the money in the book. Who stands to profit if schools are privatized?
Well, there are large corporate entities that now are looking on public education as an emerging market. And I report on several meetings that have been held among investors to talk about how to make money in the new public education market. Some of these companies are managing charter schools, and they look at them as real estate investments and having the public pay for the real estate, paying themselves outrageous amounts of rent. There are also people who've run in the charter business who really have no business running schools at all. The tennis star Andre Agassi raised $750 million to open a chain of charter schools across the country. One of them, I think, will be in Milwaukee, another in Detroit, and there'll be many more. He should be opening tennis camps. I mean, he has no educational qualifications. And similarly, in Texas and other places, there are charter schools being opened by basketball stars and football stars. These are not educators. I mean, if you step back, as I tend to do, and you look at what's happening across the country where teachers are being demoralized, blamed for conditions that are beyond their control, and where people who have no educational qualifications are taking over schools, you have to say that the American education system is under siege. There are a tsunami of bad ideas that are hitting simultaneously and really doing terrible damage to public education and to our future as a nation.
Well, let's talk about federal education policy now. You were in the Bush White House when No Child Left Behind was put into effect.
The first Bush administration.
First Bush administration. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about No Child Left Behind. What do you make of the emphasis on standardized testing and teacher accountability in No Child Left Behind?
Well, the Bush administration of George W. introduced the idea that the federal government should require every state to test every child every year from grades 3 through 8, and by the year 2014, all children in America would be proficient in math and reading. It was a total hoax. No one believed it at the time. Certainly no one believes it anymore. But even at the time, no one believed it. So it was a ridiculous law because no one believed that it was possible that someday 100% of kids 12 years later would be proficient. And yet people have been fired based on that claim. The Obama administration's policy of race to the top is built right on top of the Bush No Child Left Behind. It shares the same assumptions the standardized testing is the best way to measure school performance, and that we must constantly test children. They keep expanding who should get tested. There are now kids in kindergarten being tested. You have to understand, for context, there is no other nation in the world that tests every child every year. I mean, testing has gotten completely out of control in this country. And in most places, teachers test the children and their classes. They're not administering standardized testing. And so I think that the theory of if we just test, everyone gets smarter was a bad idea. And what it's done is to cause many schools to be declared failing schools because they don't have high test scores, and demoralize teachers, and really made many kids hate school.
We're talking to Diane Ravitch. She's an education professor at New York University, long career in the education field, talking about her new book, Reign of Error.
And we'd like to hear your thinking on this, too. What do you think about the move to privatize schools and get rid of ineffective teachers? Do you believe that our public school system is in crisis? Join the discussion by giving us a call at 800-642-1234. Or you can post a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll hear more about testing, teacher evaluation, and her solutions, Diane Ravitch's solutions, to the problems that are in the education field. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We're talking to Diane Ravitch now, former Assistant Secretary of Education and a professor at New York University. She's got a new book out challenging the move to privatize schools, and she also challenges the notion that our public education system is broken.
Her book is Reign of Error. You can join in with your thoughts on education in the United States. Is it broken? What needs to change? Do you like things the way they are? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to the phones now. We have Jay with us in Spooner. Jay, hi.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to say I agree wholeheartedly with the with your guest in terms of our public schools are not broken, and our public schools are doing a terrific job. And I have seen articles dating back into the 1960s written by professionals in education that talk about the same exact thing that we're seeing today. And we always go back to the same thing, and that is that good teaching can't be mandated any more than good parenting can be. And that really is the root of the problem, in my opinion, is poor parenting. But I think our schools do a terrific job. And this idea that we need to keep increasing test scores and cutting funding to schools at the same time, so that we can crank out little test takers, and as a result, we're losing kids who have free-thinking ability.
Gotcha. Jay, I want to jump in and get Diane to respond there. So test-taking as a way of evaluating, first of all, teachers. Why are standardized tests not a good way to figure out which teachers are effective?
Well, actually, it's the worst way to figure out which whether teachers are effective. There's just a huge body of research, and based on experience, not on theory, that what test scores show is who is in your classroom, not whether you're a good teacher or not. And what's happening is that the more these systems are adopted, which Arne Duncan has been insisting upon, and so now most states have said we will evaluate teachers by the test scores of their students, teachers are actually being punished if they are teaching English language learners because they don't see big score gains. They're being punished if they teach children with severe disabilities because they don't see big test score gains. They're being punished if they teach gifted children because they're already at the ceiling. So it's really a ridiculous way of evaluating teachers. And what happens is that, and this has happened in many districts that have tried this, 1 year a teacher is rated highly effective, next year the teacher is ineffective. So the teacher may get a bonus 1 year and then a notice she's about to be fired the next year. And if you ask the teacher, what did you do differently, he or she will say, I have no idea. I was teaching exactly the same way. So these systems don't work, have never worked, and will never work because test scores, first of all, I mean, the tests themselves just aren't that good, but you're measuring who is in the classroom. And let me just add, if I might, I hate the status quo. I am not defending the status quo. I think the status quo is what the federal government is doing and has been doing now for the past dozen years, what the states are doing because the federal government is forcing them to do it, and what governors are doing, like Scott Walker and Tom Corbett, cutting the budget and finding every possible way to make teachers feel unappreciated and disrespected, and that's no way to improve education.
All right, thanks for the call, Jay. We'll go now to John in Superior. Hi, John.
Good afternoon to both of you. I just wanted to ask your guest about the role that unions have played in this problem. It seems like you cannot get rid of bad teachers. Our school district, the only way you can get rid of somebody is if they have pornography on their computer or they have inappropriate relations with a student. And I think the unions have been very guilty of protecting very bad teachers, and the good ones and the bad ones, they all get the same pay. What is your guest's thoughts on the union's role in this?
Well, it's a good question. The reality is that if you wanted to look at where the performance is highest in America, it's in three states, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and New Jersey. The one thing that these three states have in common is that they're all highly unionized states. Now, I don't think their performance is high because they have unions, but because unions fight for resources, and when schools don't get resources, they don't improve. You have to have, when you have kids with problems, you have to have smaller classes. There are all kinds of things that schools need, and they will not get if there's no one to advocate for them. I think that the unions have to be very responsible in making sure that there's a speedy resolution if a teacher is charged with any kind of malpractice or misbehavior or incompetence, that if they're tenured, they have a right to a hearing, and the hearing should be speedy, and there should be evidence presented, and if they're guilty, they should be removed.
Thanks for the call, John. We have Mike with us now in River Falls. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I'd like to say hi to everybody. Diane, I love your book, Reign of Error. Just finished it. I'm an administrator in River Falls. I know we're going to disagree on this. I really like the Common Core for reading language arts as opposed to our 1998 standards in Wisconsin. However, I do agree with you with all the testing that we have to do. I like to call it the oxymoronic smarter balance assessment, because I know what it does to our kids. Third graders taking tests for gosh knows how long. I just want to get your insight on how you're supporting others to kind of buck the trend of what should states and districts do to kind of get out of this testing fiasco?
Well, I believe, and I'm actually very optimistic, I believe there's a national movement building from the grassroots up. People are beginning to understand in state after state that their schools are being destroyed, that teachers are being destroyed. You cannot have a better education system if you demoralize teachers. Our schools cannot be staffed by kids who've had a few weeks of training and they're right out of college, and then they come and go. That's Teach for America. And yet places like Minneapolis is being taken over by Teach for America, and many experienced teachers are being laid off. So I think that there is a grassroots movement. We can see even, for example, in the state of Texas, the moms, the suburban moms, got so angry there that they buttonholed all the legislators, and Texas just reduced its testing requirements. In Florida, Michelle Rhee and also Jeb Bush were trying to push something called the parent trigger, where parents could sign a petition and then hand their school over to a corporation. And the moms and the dads in Florida got so angry they couldn't even find a single parent to testify in favor of what they call the parent trigger or parent empowerment. And that bill was defeated not just once but twice. So in state after state, there are grassroots groups. I could put in a plug for the Network for Public Education, the organization that I started, which is to try to connect all the grassroots groups across the country, and they're springing up in Ohio and Pennsylvania and California. They're everywhere. And these are people who are saying, that's enough. The testing has gotten out of control. Handing over our public schools to corporations is inappropriate. We don't want our tax dollars to go to profit-making organizations. So there's a lot of pushback, and it's coming from high school students, from teachers, from parents, and communities.
Diane, in our last minute and a half or so, a lot of your book is geared toward solutions to problems that do exist in the school system. I want to talk about one, or the first couple, actually, that start before kids even go to school. What can young children, what can we do for young children that helps school performance?
Well, the important thing to bear in mind is that the achievement gap exists before the first day of school. So anything that we can do to make sure that young children have the opportunity to encounter social interchange with other kids, learn how to play well, exposed to new vocabulary. In other words, universal pre-K, we're way behind the rest of the advanced world. I quote a study from The Economist magazine comparing us to Europe and the advanced nations of North America, we are like number 32 or 34 in terms of providing universal pre-K. It's just taken for granted in other countries. We don't do it here. Medical care for poor kids is particularly important because they fall farther and farther behind because they miss school because of preventable illnesses. There are so many things that we could do to make school more lively, more engaging. Every school should have a wonderful arts program. There's no reason in the world that so many schools don't have the arts anymore or that they're cutting it back on physical education. Kids have to have a reason to come to school other than to be tested.
Diane, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
That was Diane Ravitch, former Assistant Secretary of Education, professor at New York University. We've been talking about her new book, Reign of Error.
And coming up next, Twitter is making a splash with its initial stock offering. We'll find out what's going on. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Some big news on Wall Street today as Twitter revealed their billion-dollar IPO plan.
That's right. Financials of the social media messaging service were announced yesterday, and the potential buyers of Twitter stock are finally able to take a look at some of the details, some of the numbers. Joining us now to discuss the news is Zachary Seward, a former Wall Street Journal reporter, and now senior editor of Quartz, a digital news outlet. Zach, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I'd like to start with the basics on this. How closely has this Twitter offering been watched? Who's following it?
Well, it's probably the highest profile IPO, or at least tech IPO, since Facebook. And, you know, part of that has to do with the fact that so many people use these services that when they enter the financial markets, it's just naturally more of interest. It doesn't mean it's larger than other companies going public. It's just going to create a lot more buzz.
And it's not quite as large as Facebook. I heard one analyst call the Facebook offering a disaster, and I don't know if that's true, but I'd be interested in your thoughts on the Facebook offering and how it compares with this and maybe some lessons that the Twitter offering learned from that.
Yeah, I might go for the word debacle.
Okay, that's
disaster.
Pretty good.
And that refers specifically to the Facebook IPO itself. Nowadays, Facebook has really recovered. It's trading at record highs. Social media stocks in general are doing very well, and that's part of the reason Twitter has timed its IPO for right about now. But the Facebook IPO went through a lot of hiccups, and I think in retrospect, people say that part of the problem was overheated anticipation of the offering itself. People got really excited. They overvalued Facebook. Facebook itself made some last-minute disclosures that rattled investors. There were problems on the first day of trading. What people close to Twitter's IPO tell me is that if nothing else, they're trying to have the anti-Facebook IPO to do this as quickly and quietly as they can.
And they had some help in that regard, right? There are some federal laws that changed that allowed them to make changes to the offering without disclosing it before now.
That's right. It's called the Jobs Act. It's a little more than a year old, and it's supposed to help so-called emerging growth companies go public or facilitate some of their options. I don't think people would generally think of Twitter, which has now 2,000 employees, as an emerging growth company or a small business, but because it has under $1 billion in annual revenue, it can take advantage of the Jobs Act. That meant it could submit its IPO filing secretly or confidentially to the SEC and get feedback and confidence before making public the document that it did yesterday.
So let's talk a little bit about what we've learned about Twitter since yesterday. One of the things we've learned is about some big gains in revenue that we've been seeing, but they've also got some big expenses on their books, too.
Yeah, exactly. I think the most impressive thing we saw was that in just about 2 years, Twitter went from almost no the advertising revenue to a really significant advertising business. And last year it generated $317 million in revenue. This year it'll make a significant gain on that, it appears. That said, it lost $79 million last year, and it has, it turns out, never been profitable. And that, of course, raises the age-old question that, about these tech companies, which is why anyone would invest in an unprofitable company. Of course, if you are investing in Twitter, you're making a bet that it has a lot of growth still to go.
Yeah, in fact, I read another analyst who called the Twitter losses a non-issue. And, you know, for us civilians out here, how can that be? How can a company be in business for 6 or 7 years, lose all that money, and still be attractive to investors?
Well, here's the charitable answer, charitable to Twitter.
Okay.
You know, they've focused on making the best experience they can and growing the number of users as fast as they can. And they've been really successful at that. They disclose they have 218 million monthly active users, that is people who use it at least once a month. That's a pretty good number, though, of course, as you said, it's very small compared to Facebook. And those 218 million people who do use it tend to love it and are extremely engaged with the service. So at that, Twitter's been very successful. But yes, if you're making a bet on the company itself, you have to bet that it's going to be able to turn that engagement into actual money. So far it has been, just not enough money to show a profit.
And one of the things they have to be looking for, as opposed to people who are jumping in trying to make a quick profit and then get out, are those long-term investors, and that's what they're trying to appeal to here. Are they sending the correct message to those types of people that we're going to be around for the long term and that we're a bet that's worth making?
Yeah, I mean, they seem to be, and then any time you're entering the public markets, that's more or less what you're saying. IPOs are a little funny. The day before you start publicly trading is actually when the very first shares are distributed, and those go to insiders, people who are close to the banks that are underwriting the IPO, very wealthy individuals and institutions. They get the stock at the IPO price. It's only until the next day when it starts trading on the actual market, the stock market, that individual investors like you and me get a crack at investing in Twitter. That's what happened with Facebook. You know, people got in at a lower buying price, and then the average investor, for a while at least, seemed to have really been hosed by the deal.
And one of the things we should have mentioned this, but the IPO is a couple weeks away yet. We've got this whole roadshow process that's got to carry itself out. How does that work? What are we be seeing then?
By law, Twitter has to wait 3 weeks from its filing, which was yesterday, before it starts this so-called roadshow. That's when it markets itself to potential large investors, goes around the country, and roadshow is a pretty appropriate term. It holds large meetings in which it goes through the details in this prospectus and tries to make itself look as attractive an investment as possible. That won't take very long, the roadshow, and Twitter's goal here is to start trading as a public company before Thanksgiving.
And I imagine their other goal is not to have any surprises, although there are going to be people looking at these things, and they'll be answering questions as part of this whole process.
Yeah, that's true. They may also have to make amendments to the filing, and that will, of course, be closely watched. Twitter is, you're correct, trying to do this as quietly and with as few bumps as possible, but that, you know, becomes less and less in your control when you enter the public markets. And at this point, anything could happen, including, I mean, we're in the middle of a government shutdown. The SEC has said it will remain open and process IPOs for, quote, a few weeks. That probably will be long enough for Twitter to pull off its IPO, but it's not 100% sure.
You know, another thing we haven't talked about so much is sort of the whole advertising market, what that looks like these days. And there's lots of competition for advertising. Prices there are being stressed. We've seen the income for Twitter going up, but at the same time, there have to be some questions there.
Correct. Twitter disclosed that it generates 85% of its revenue from advertising. So it's pretty much an ad company, just like Facebook, just like Google. And it, as I said, built that app business in pretty much the last 2 years, which is very impressive. At the same time, it has a ton of competition, and it also disclosed that the rates that it charges for advertising have been declining, and that's a big risk, of course, to its business. The brightest note in the filing, I think, was that Twitter said 65% of its ad revenue comes from mobile devices, people's smartphones, essentially. That's really interesting because it contrasts starkly with Facebook. At the time of its IPO, 0% of Facebook's ad revenue was coming from mobile. And now Twitter is saying 65% of its revenue is mobile. That sort of reflects a broader shift in the web as a whole. And it does seem to suggest that Twitter is well positioned to maintain its business at the very least as people increasingly use their phones and abandon desktop computers.
All right. Well, Zachary Seward, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate your time. Zachary Seward's been with us talking about the Twitter IPO that we've all been hearing about. And if you're going to be looking for that on the exchange, by the way, their symbol is going to be TWTR. So keep your eyes open for that. Zachary Seward, senior editor of the digital news outlet Quartz. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now that the weather is getting colder, and as we just heard in the news, much colder in certain parts of the upper Midwest, hot food is making its way back into the kitchen.
Well, one of the great things to eat when it's chilly outside is chili. So we thought for Food Friday this week, we'd talk to a chili expert.
And we've got a great one. Here to share his chili expertise with us is John Raven. He is a writer for TexasCooking.com. He has a couple of degrees we need to talk about, a Ph.B., that is a Doctor of Barbecue Philosophy, and a Ph.C., a Doctor of Chili Philosophy. John Raven, welcome to Central Time. And John Raven is there someplace. He should be here now. John, welcome to Central Time. Are you here now?
Thank you.
There we go. Sorry about that. We had a little confusion with buttons and all of that. I want to start out with your educational background because, as you know, the Central Time audience is highly educated, and titles mean a great deal to us. We've had PhDs here, MDs, BAs, MAs. We've never had a PhB or a PhC before. Tell me a little bit about how you earn those.
Well, the important part of my education we want to get first, which laid the basis for everything else, I am a high school graduate. I graduated from Taylor High School in 1956, and from there it's just been uphill. The Ph.B. is Doctor of Barbecue Philosophy. That is one of 30 of the degrees or less that's been handed out in the world, and I got one for my work in the development and promotion of barbecue and the barbecue industry. The Ph.D. is for my work in the chili world. That's a Doctor of Chili Philosophy. And I've been hanging around the chili world for 40 years now, so I've stirred a lot of chili in my time.
Well, you wrote that you learned to cook chili in large part through trial and error. What kind of errors did you make that you'd say steer clear of this to people trying to make their own chili?
I'm sorry, I repeat that.
What kind of errors would you warn people away from when they're trying to cook their chili?
Oh, the first thing is it takes a while. It's not something you can throw together in 10 minutes. The basic natural chili meat is tough beef, which will need 3 or 4 hours of slow simmering to really get it to perfection. And other errors is not reading the recipe and not really understanding what you're doing. The basis of chili is the dried chili pepper. And I've heard of recipes that didn't include that, so that wouldn't make it chili. The official correct name for the dish we call chili is chili con carne, which is Spanish for chili with meat. And what it is in basically is meat cooked in a sauce made from the meat of the pepper plants.
I want to ask you a question about during the time you've been involved in not just making chili, but judging chili. It seems as though the stature of chili has gone way up. You know, when I was a kid, if we got chili out of a can, that was considered to be a pretty big deal, or my mom's Betty Crocker recipe. But today, it seems as though chili is really an excellent, fine, high-quality food product that everybody talks about, raves about, and tries to perfect. How has chili changed since you've been involved in it?
This goes back to the chili cook-offs. We started having contests to see who could cook the best chili. And that brings out the best recipes. And over the approximately 50 years now that that's been going on, the chili has elevated. And the makers of the commercial chili, they've had to come along with the rest of us to stay in demand, because just the bad old chili they had years ago is not going to make it right now.
So does chili have to be hot and spicy to be good?
It needs to be spicy. The hot part is up to the individual taste. There is a feeling that's going around that chili is supposed to be just as hot with the chili pepper as you can get it, and that is not true. You want it at your comfort zone, and that goes for any recipe. We want the recipe to suit you. We're not out there running a McChili's and trying to save everybody in the world. We want you and your family to be happy with the dish and stay right there.
So what's different when you're cooking chili as opposed to when you are judging in a chili competition? You know, on the one hand, you're trying to make the best product. Then on the other side of things, you're tasting all these different fantastic or maybe not so fantastic chilies. How are those two things different? And what do you look for in a good chili when you are the judge?
We judge chili first by its appearance. Want it to have a nice reddish brown color to it. And we want the consistency. It should not be too thin or too thick. We used to use a little test there where you would see if the spoon would stand up in the bowl of chili. If it did, it was just right on the verge of being too thick, but past being too thin. And don't want pieces of unidentified matter floating around in it.
Now, how about beans? Some people put them in, some people don't. Is it right or wrong to use beans in the chili?
I would say 95% of your chili recipes call for beans. Now, here in Texas, we're different. In Texas chili, there are no beans. You can have beans cooked on the side and served with the chili, but they cannot be cooked together.
Are there any other regional differences like that? I mean, we know Texas is different. That sort of goes without saying. But in other parts of the country, is there something you run into and you say, oh, yeah, that's from the Northeast or something like that?
Well, there are a couple of places that are, shall we say, hotbeds of chili. We've got Cincinnati. They have a big string of chili parlors up there. And what they're serving is not really chili. It's a pasta with a chili sauce on it. But they call it chili, and they're happy with it, so I'm happy for them. And then over in Illinois, we have the double L chili, which is spelled with two L's instead of just one. And it's good chili over there. But they just never did learn how to spell it correctly.
Well, we're close to Illinois, so we know all about that.
So the best way I have eaten chili in my life, I'm from the Detroit area of Michigan, and we serve it on hot dogs there. No beans, of course. Coney Island dog, they call it for some reason. Hot dog, chili sauce, onions, and mustard. Is it wrong to put my chili on a hot dog?
No. Right. Let me tell you a little short story here. Back in 1977, we were working to get chili named the official dish of the state of Texas. And we were having a lot of competition from gumbo from down in southeast Texas. And someone on our side stood up and made a speech, and he said, the reason chili needs to be the dish is you can put it on a hot dog, but you can't put gumbo on a hot dog.
Oh, my gosh.
Did that happen? Did they make chili the official dish of Texas?
Chili is the official dish of the state of Texas.
Well, that is terrific news. That's good for us to know and good to keep in mind. We're in Texas.
We got an awful lot of publicity on it when Lyndon Johnson was in the White House. He had chili suppers out here at the ranch, the Texas White House, and made chili very popular.
All right, John, thank you so much for sharing the chili stories with us. Really appreciate it.
I enjoyed being here. If there's anything you need to know about anything else, Texas style or southwestern style, you've got my phone number. Just call me up. If I don't have an answer, I'll make one up for you.
We like that.
Thanks a lot. That was John Raven. He's a writer for TexasCooking.com. And you can share your favorite chili recipe or tip on the Central Time Facebook page.